Accession number 18209, Reel 2.
Major Lethart, Reel 2. You were just telling me about the Tarkos and Chetris. Yeah. Did they get on with each other all right?
Oh, yes, yes. What do you mean, the Tarkos and Chetris? Oh, yes, yes. There was no discrimination at all.
Was there any difference in quality between them as far as soldierliness was concerned?
No, I don't think so.
So you were just telling me about the preparations for going into battle with the Chindits.
Yeah. We, having done all this training, we then moved to an airfield called Lala Ghat and camped round the airfield, actually. Again, practicing up, setting up bivouacs and things, living on these rations. And it was from there that we actually flew in to Burma. The CO and the intelligence officer were to go the night before, and their glider broke loose before it got off the runway and ploughed into the side. It also had a horse and a small bulldozer in the front. And they were actually all right, but the bulldozer and the horse wasn't. So the CO, that was a bad start as far as the CO was concerned, and he came in with us later the next day. These Dakotas, luckily, we went in planes and not gliders, but each Dakota towed two gliders on long nylon ropes. And it was the most extraordinary sight to see these Dakotas lumbering down the runway, gradually getting into the air, and then behind them these two gliders being dragged off the ground. It was extraordinary sight that first evening, seeing the other troops go off, and these planes lumbering into the air and having to climb up to 6,000 feet to get over the hills into Burma. And some of the gliders were going into what was called Broadway, where we eventually went, and a lot of them piled up on landing there, and there were a lot of casualties amongst the people in the gliders. The planes themselves landed quite happily, but the gliders produced a lot of casualties. The following, that was the first night. I think I should go back a bit, actually, because there were two places which were chosen for the possible airfields. One was called Broadway and the other was called Chowringhee, after the main street in Calcutta. And Chowringhee was chosen, actually, as the place to go. But 48 hours before the operation was about to begin, the reconnaissance plane discovered that there were logs being put out on what was going to be the airfield, the open space. And it looked as though the Japs got wind of the thing. And there was some discussion as to whether we should go ahead with it or not, 2 days before the operation was due to begin. But Wingate wasn't having any of it. He said, no, we'll abandon Chowringhee and we'll all go into what became Broadway. And it subsequently was discovered that the logs dragged out onto what was Chowringhee were part of an ordinary forestry operation and nothing to do with the Japs at all. However, Broadway was where we went, and I still remember the flight in, sitting round the in this Dakota. getting colder and colder as we got higher and higher up, because there were no air conditioning or anything. And the men started opening their blankets and covering themselves. And it was very cold indeed at 6,000 feet. And over the mountains we went. And then we started to come down. And it was a remarkable sight looking down at the this thick Burmese jungle. And there, in the middle of it all, was a large space all lit up. And down we came, and bumping along, landed on this recently made airstrip. And we all jumped out wondering whether we were going to be shot at or not. As it happened, we weren't, and we were able to go to the part of the jungle which had been chosen as our stronghold base near the airfield. And we passed as we marched in the night, of course, and as we marched along past these paraffin burning lights which were lighting the strip, the smell of death which accompanied us for the rest of the campaign really came from these gliders which had crashed into the jungle. Nobody had had time to remove the corpses. It was a chilling experience, really, to land there in the middle of nowhere with this horrid smell. And however, we went into the jungle, spent the night, and the following morning had to get down to digging foxholes and putting wire around down at where I was dropped by planes. And after about a week or so, we had a really strong defensive position on the edge of the runway, which was then used by the RAF. Hurricanes came in and were based there, and the Americans had some B-25s which were based on the airfield. We had a what's known as a floating company out all the time round about, just to warn if any Japs were coming near. And nothing much happened for a month or more. The airfield was used by the Hurricanes for supporting troops further north in the Imphal area, and the American B-25s were used to support Stillwell, who was coming down from the Burma roadway towards Mogong. And then one day we suddenly heard the noise of aeroplanes, and I think it was about 12 Japanese bombers came over at a great height and dropped bombs onto us, onto the defensive position. And they caused remarkably few casualties. One or two men were hit by splinters, I think. But these foxholes that we'd dug, which were quite deep, very good protection, and we had very few casualties indeed from this bombing raid, which they went one way and they turned around and came back the other way and dropped some more bombs. And one or two of them went onto the airfield, and we were soon able to fill in the holes. And a day or two later, the floating company was attacked by Japs trying to get to the airfield. But they didn't press their attack, and there was quite a lot of fighting, not actually at the airfield, but about a mile away. And The Japs, in fact, retreated, and we later heard that they were carrying quite a number of casualties with them as they went.
That wasn't your company, which was a floating company?
No, it wasn't, no.
So did you come into contact with the Japs at that time?
No, no, I personally didn't. Shortly after that, Wingate paid us a visit, came in there, and he came in a B-25, an American B-25, and I went out with his ADC and him to the plane when he was going off, and he... There were two American war correspondents also there. And after the... Wingate was just about to shut the door of the plane when these Americans came running up and said, "Say, General, can you give us a lift?" And the pilots said, "We've already got a lot of... quite a load already. I wouldn't advise them coming." Wingate took no notice at all and hauled the two of the chaps in. And the plane took off. Looked a bit odd. It didn't take off very well. And then we heard, the same night actually, that the plane was missing. And all on board reckoned to have been killed. And I thought at the time, this must have been because the plane was overloaded. But actually what had happened was, he had landed at Imphal and taken off again from Imphal and crashed shortly after that, so that I wasn't, in fact, the last person to see him, as it were, although at the time I thought I was. But why the plane crashed has never been known. Maybe an electric storm, maybe the plane was, in fact, overloaded, or one of the books I read about Wingate suggested that one of the engines was not producing full power when they took off from Broadway, but I don't know, but the thing remains a mystery what happened. But his death really knocked the stuffing out of the second Chindit campaign. And his successor, Brigadier Len Tain, was... he couldn't match Wingate in his fire in his belly, you might say, and the way he led people.
How many of these American hitchhikers were there?
Two.
Who were they?
I don't know. They were American war correspondents. They were killed as well, actually.
Did they have any luggage?
They didn't, no. They'd been in for the day, I think.
Had you seen them before this?
No. I don't know what they were doing. Whether they were interviewing the RAF people or not, I don't know, but they certainly never came near us. Shortly after that, they decided that our campaign in that particular part of North Burma should move north towards Mogong and the Chinar. And we were told to abandon Broadway and the airfield and move, march north to another stronghold, actually on the railway, which was named Blackpool. And we marched for several days. and eventually got to Blackpool. We arrived on the edge of the jungle in the early morning, and there were a lot of crumps going on, Japanese mortars and things firing into the stronghold. And the CO decided the best thing to do was to just march straight across the open country into the stronghold and hope for the best. And as it happened, that worked. The Japs were so keen on bombarding the stronghold itself, they either didn't look or didn't bother to take any notice of us marching across the open country. We got into the stronghold, Blackpool, without any difficulty. And the commander there was Jack Masters, who's written several books, as you know. He was sort of acting brigadier, you might say. And the first time I saw him, he had nothing on except a pair of shorts made out of an old parachute, which was a strange way to meet one's brigadier. Although we didn't know it at the time, he'd already decided that the place was untenable and should be abandoned. However, we were there for several days, and very unpleasant days, I must say, because a lot of bombardment, and the place was hell of a mess, really. Jap corpses all around the outside, and stench of death and latrines and things. Really, was a dreadful place to be. Certainly the most unpleasant place I've ever been in. And we were there for several days. And when I took over our positions in the stronghold from British battalion, I can't remember which one it was, but I jumped into a slit trench to have a look what the field of fire was before putting anyone there. And there was a soldier in this trench, sitting there looking out, and he didn't seem to take any notice of me, so I tapped him on the shoulder, and he just fell over like that. Rigor mortis, he'd been dead for I don't know how long. What surprised me was that nobody seemed to know he was there and was dead. That was a slightly unnerving experience, I must say. However, the orders came to withdraw, and we had to withdraw over a number of ranges of small hills, and we left a lot of heavy equipment behind. It was impossible to take it. And what was sad was many of the mules we had to abandon. The Gurkhas are very fond of their mules, and they absolutely hated leaving the mules behind. It was a terrible thing, they thought. And however, we had to leave some behind, and I think we probably took more than we should have done, because the Gurkhas were determined to try and rescue as many mules as possible. And getting them over these hills, and it was raining like hell, it was a monsoon, and the paths are terribly slippery. Getting these mules up, men pushing them behind and struggling along. And
were you actually in action at Blackpool?
Yes, we weren't in action, weren't going out, we were just defending the place. At night, night attacks and things.
What were the Japanese attacks like?
Well, they were pretty vigorous, I must say, and totally disregarded casualties. And in the morning, you'd find a whole lot of corpses lying around the wire outside, about which you could do nothing, or didn't really want to do anything, but it didn't improve the sanitary arrangements of the place.
So were they like human wave attacks?
No, they were attacks of small parties, I think I'd say, supported by mortar fire. We had quite a lot of casualties there, quite a lot of wounded. That was one, another problem, leaving the place, was to carry the wounded as well. And it was a... It took 2 days, I think, to get over the hills. And some of the casualties suffered terrible pain and difficulties.
Had the Japanese attacks got in amongst your D Company?
No. No, they never got into us. We were there. Mm.
What weapons were you using against their attack?
Bren guns, mostly. Occasionally throwing a few grenades and things over the wire in the hopes it might damage somebody. We're halfway over these mountains, we were suddenly met by a battalion of the West African Rifles.
The West African Frontier Force.
Yeah. And the Gurkhas are rather prudish about being naked. I mean, they never, when they washed themselves, they never kind of took all their clothes off and all kept on their pants on. And these Africans, when we met them, none of them were wearing anything at all, which was a nice way of keeping your clothes clean, I must say. And the Gurkhas were sort of raised eyebrows when these chaps, they were very helpful and carried a lot of stuff, but it was an unusual sight to see people with nothing on at all carrying bits of equipment around. And I remember that Gurkhas were slightly surprised at this. We eventually got over it and set ourselves up just by the Indorje Lake, which is a big lake in northern Burma, and had to re-equip really with airdrops and things. And it took several, a week or so, I suppose, to re-equip. And all these casualties, not only our battalion, but other casualties, were all lying there under temporary shelters. We were wondering how on earth we were going to get them out. And somebody somewhere had the bright idea that why not fly in a Sunderland flying boat and land it on the lake. It's never been done before. And the ceiling of these Sunderlands was somewhere around, I believe, 6 to 10,000 feet. And anyhow, one morning we heard this plane noise, and sure enough, a Sunderland flying boat came in and landed on the lake. And this was repeated several days, and all the casualties were taken out in this flying boat. Which was a great help and relieved the doctors a lot of worry. I remember that one particular day, whilst we were there, as I often did, went off by myself onto the top of a hill to watch birds, get away from everything, and I was looking towards the lake, and suddenly out of the jungle, across a marshy bit, came a whole line of wild elephants, one after another, little ones and big ones. And we'd heard them and seen plenty of signs of them, but I'd never actually seen them before. And I was pleased about this, and I went down and said to the first to my colleagues, I'd just seen a very wonderful sight. And he said, you may have seen a wonderful sight, but I've heard a much better one. We've just heard of the D-Day landings. So I was scuppered there. My information wasn't half so appreciated as I might have been. And that was, I think, 6th or 7th of June, was it?
The D-Day landings were the 6th of June.
6th of June. That was when we were at the Indoorjee Lake. I remember it came over the radio, the landing had taken place. A few days after that, we got instructions to march north to towards Mogong. And there was a little river, I think it was running out of the Indoorjee Lake, which the Japs were using as a sort of LFC, I think, or a valley, and yeah, they were using the LFC. And D Company and I were ordered to go to a village on this little lake, a little stream, and where the Japs were supposed to be, have a position. So we went, marched off, and I decided to do an attack at dawn on this place. So we set up a base and had an evening meal and left a few chaps with our heavy equipment. And we crept up to within quite a reasonable distance of the village and spent a very uncomfortable night being bitten by most mosquitoes and things. And in the morning we I sent one platoon one way and one another to stop the stop gaps. And I, with a central platoon, went into the village. And the platoon on the right came in contact with some Japs apparently coming up to the village, and they had a bit of a battle. And unfortunately, the section commander was hit, and I went up there to see what was going on, and he actually died whilst I was trying to do something for him. And then I went back to the central of the village with my Gurkha officer to see what was going on elsewhere. And suddenly there was a loud bang. And I was almost knocked off my feet, but just managed to stand up by something hitting me here.
That's your left arm.
Left arm. And I didn't feel anything but complete surprise on what on earth had happened. And then I looked down and found that my forearm, this bit, was hanging down here. And a lot of blood flying around. And my Gurkha officer was standing next to me, said, "I've also been hit." In fact, he hadn't, but a bit of my ulna flew off from me into his chest, damaging him slightly. But he then, I more or less collapsed, and he coped with the situation, put tourniquets and things on, and my orderly who was with me saw where the Jap had fired from and rushed into the jungle and actually killed a fellow in the kukri. After that, I had moments of consciousness and